You are listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice. And for The Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. This is another portion, the second part, of an interview with Dr. James Schmidt, who is Chief of Internal Medicine at the VA's McGuire Veterans Hospital here in Richmond. Dr. Schmidt has written a book of anecdotes detailing his career in medicine. The book is titled Speed Bumps and Tsetse Flies. Dr. Schmidt is with me in the studio of the Virginia Voice. Dr. Schmidt, you have written a book of personal anecdotes. What is your overall philosophy of medicine?
I think it is nice and good to take care of people who are less fortunate. And you can make a huge difference in the right place. You go to the right place, you can save a life. Because if the medicine is not optimum and you can walk in and teach and save someone, okay. I was in the country of Azerbaijan, actually on 9/11, when the World Trade Center was hit. There is something called the Azerbaijan Project, which was coordinated by Medical College of Virginia. And I was there with another doctor, Andy Whiting, and Stephanie Alexander, who's a nurse. We were there in Baku, which is the capital of the country. What had happened, I flew in there. I wound up at the Baku Hilton at the courtesy of the country. I took a nap. I woke up. I went for a walk. Saw a ruin called the Tower of the Maiden, came back, took another nap, and I woke up, turned the TV on, and there was the World Trade Center on fire. I was horrified, of course, and at one moment I thought, well, maybe it's a private plane crashed in, and then next moment another plane crashes in, and this is not an accident, this is not one plane. Then I watched it for a while, and both buildings collapsed, and all the people were, I saw people jumping, everybody was smashed to atoms. It was absolutely horrible, wrenching experience. And I went down to the lobby. The maitre d' knew I was an American. He talked quietly like he was coming to a funeral. He asked me if I wanted anything. I said, yeah, he brought me a Coke. He says, no charge. I mean, they knew something horrible had happened to America. Then Andy White, who's a doctor from Shenandoah Valley, and Stephanie Alexander, who's a nurse, a cardiac nurse in Richmond, came. And when I told them what happened, they were devastated. Stephanie had a sister in the Pentagon, and she was crying. Fortunately, she called the Pentagon, and she found out her sister was okay. So the next day, we talked about going home, or should we just leave? We couldn't leave, of course, because you couldn't get planes out anyway to the U.S. We decided, well, the whole purpose of terrorism is to disrupt, and we're not going to let our teaching schedule be disrupted. That's what we're going to teach. So the next day, we went to the hospital, and there was a doctor with dinner. He had a dinner for us, and there was a Dr. Raphael, who was the chief of medicine there. And he said, the president of Azerbaijan has declared a moment of silence for the victims at the World Trade Center. And then he actually launched into a tirade about Azerbaijan's problems with terrorism. They were next to Armenia, and they were fighting Armenia, and there's a big... One of the reasons for my presence there was for goodwill from the U.S. to Azerbaijan. So he talked about this. Well, I had to give a lecture. I had an interpreter. His name was Rashad, 21-year-old man who spoke English like he'd grown up in New Jersey. This man, I couldn't believe he actually been in, but he was my interpreter. And I was going to give a lecture on the thyroid. And I've never given a lecture through an interpreter of my life. So I said, I got to check this out. So I said, I'll tell a joke first to my interpreter. Rashad looked at me and says, Dr. Schmidt, in Azerbaijan, we don't tell jokes. I said, I'm going to tell a joke about the president. And he said, in Azerbaijan, we don't make jokes about the president. It's a dictation. I said, that's okay. In America, we do. So I told a joke. I'm going to tell a joke through my interpreter to my audience, which was out there, which is all women except one man. Almost all of the doctors in Azerbaijan are women. I'm telling this joke through my interpreter. Some people may have heard it. George Bush went to England and he met with Queen Elizabeth. And he said, you know, Elizabeth, you're not real smart and I'm not real smart, but you do well as a leader. How do you do it? She said, very well, simple, George. I surround myself with good men. He said, well, how do you know who's good? She said, I give them a little test. He says, like what? I'll show you. So Elizabeth calls Tony Blair in, who's the prime minister, and she says, Tony, I'm thinking of someone. It's your parent's son, but it's not your brother. Who is it? Tony thinks, that would be me. She says, right. She says, Elizabeth says, George, see how easy that is? So George Bush says, I'm going to try. He calls Dan Quayle, who is not regarded as a very intelligent person in U.S. politics, as you know. And he said, Dan, I'm going to give you a little test. I'm thinking of someone. It's your parent's son, but it's not your brother. Who is it? Dan thinks, and he thinks, and he thinks, and he thinks. And he says, I'll get back to you. So Dan calls Colin Powell. And he says, Colin, help me with this. I'm thinking of someone. It's your parent's son, but it's not your brother. Who is it? And Colin Powell says, that would be me. So thanks. And so Dan Quayle gets the answer. He calls George Bush up. And he says, I have the answer. It's Colin Powell. And George Bush says, wrong. It's Tony Blair. So this joke was translated to my audience out there. When the translation occurred, they laughed. Now, this was the day after 9/11. It was good that the day after 9/11 in another country, I could show that in America, it's okay to make jokes about the president. That's the part of this.
You have some wonderful anecdotes. All of the things that you have been talking about in the last several moments have been anecdotes from your book.
Correct.
And absolutely. How many are in there? I read them.
There are 56 chapters. So there are 56 chapters. Some are, you know, have more than one anecdote. I told you the one about the chocolate cake. In that same chapter, which I told the chocolate cake, I went, that horrible experience in my residency in Alameda County Hospital where you were constantly sleep deprived and scared that you're going to kill a patient, and then the sadistic chief of medicine, Dr. Raker, crucified you on Saturday morning about your mistakes. The one rest time was you went to the chronic care hospital. It's a rehabilitation hospital called Fairmont. So I had 1 month at Fairmont, this other hospital. And it's an easygoing place. They did not have pagers in those days, at least there. If they wanted to get a hold of a doctor at Fairmont, there was a tall pole, wooden pole, in the middle of the grounds. And at the top of the pole was a loudspeaker. So if they wanted to get the doctor, like they'd say, Dr. Schmidt, you hear them call you over the loudspeaker. And you go to at the base of the pole was a phone. You pick up the phone, and the operator would tell you where you were supposed to be. The chief of the place was an old Jewish man named Fritz Schmerl, who rode around the place on a bicycle. He was a philosopher. So I am there working in this hospital. I haven't seen any patients in 3 days. I'm interested in endocrinology. Finally, one day I'm paged. My voice comes over the loudspeaker. I run to the phone. The operator says, Dr. Schmidt, yeah, this is Dr. Schmidt. They need you in J Building. So I run up to J Building, and J Building is the chronic care place. People are basically brain dead often. There are very few talking people. And I walk, all I can hear is an iron lung or something. And I walk into the building, and the nurse, who's new, she says, you Dr. Schmidt? I said, yes. She said, we have a patient for you to see. I said, I'd like to see his record first. She looked at me odd, like you want to see his record. So she brought me, she disappeared, and it was a woman, actually, and she brought on a wheelchair, using it as a wheelbarrow, she had about 5 foot thick of yellow pages. This patient has been there like 20 years. And I said, I'm going to do a good job. So I took the charts into a room and started reading about this patient. This was an old lady. 20 years earlier, she had become depressed, tried to kill herself, put a gun to her head, bullet went through her brain, wiped out the pituitary gland, the master gland in her body, and made her essentially brain dead. But she was breathing alive, you know. And I'm going through this her record, all of her endocrine problems. Because I was into endocrinology, I'm taking notes, and I'm going to tune this woman up and write an impressive endocrinology consult on her. And the nurse kept coming in and saying, when are you going to see the patient? I said, no, I have to go through the record. So several hours go by, and I have about 12 pages of notes. Now I'll see the patient. I walked into the room. The patient is an old lady. She's lying in the bed with eyes straight up, not moving. She's essentially in coma, except her eyes are open. And I look at the patient, and the nurse goes to the foot of the bed, and she pulls the covers off. And this woman has the most humongous toenails I've ever seen. Her toenails have not been cut in 15, 20 years. They're like the claws of a bear. It's like a trapper. A bear hunter would clip these and hang them around his neck, and it was like that. And I was shocked. I looked at the feet, and the nurse looked at me, and she said, aren't you Dr. Schmidt, the podiatrist? We called you to cut her toenails. So for that month, at least, at Fairmont Hospital, there were two Dr. Schmidts, me and the podiatrist. They wanted the podiatrist, not me. So I took my papers and I threw them in the wastebasket. I walked out the door. I was sort of dejected about this. The next day, I told Dr. Schmerl, the old, wise old director of the hospital, what had happened. And he patted me on the shoulder and he said, just be on the safe side. From now on, you should carry toenail clippers with you everywhere you go.
Funny stories all. To get just a tad serious, you're an endocrinologist.
Right.
What have been the advances in endocrinology in the last several years?
What are the advances in endocrinology? I tell you about drugs, for example. When I started out like a medical student to treat low thyroid function, we had something called thyroid extract, which was it came from the thyroids of pigs and beef. You would take this extract and it would treat your thyroid. Now we have a synthetic drug called levothyroxine. It's all synthetic. Diabetes has many, many drugs for treating diabetes now. When I started out, I'm an endocrinologist, I can tell you a story about that too. There was no proof that treating diabetes prevented complications. As you know, there are complications of diabetes, eye problems, kidney problems, heart problems. There was no real proof that getting the sugar down did anything. So finally what happened was there was a study called the DCCT study where they looked at how it is controlling the diabetes, getting the sugar down to close to a normal range, prevent complications, and yes, it does. So that we know that treating diabetes now prevents complications, and we have other drugs for diabetes. When I did my endocrine fellowship, I have a story. It's called The Woman Who Thought She Was Going to Disappear. And when I was in California, there was the University of California at San Francisco, there was a pituitary problems. It was a pituitary center. There's a disease called Cushing's disease. Cushing's disease, your pituitary gland makes a substance called ACTH, which stimulates your adrenal glands. Your adrenal glands sit on top of your kidney to make cortisone. The net effect is in Cushing's disease, there's too much cortisone. This makes you fat and round and diabetic and everything. In those days, the way to treat Cushing's disease was they would have to do a major surgery, pull the brain up, pull the brain back, and take out this tumor, which was kind of a nasty procedure. Well, a new technique came up, a technique called transsphenoidal. What would happen would be the doctor would go in, go through the roof of your mouth, up through your maxillary sinuses, go up through your sinuses, drill a hole in the roof of your skull, in the bottom of your skull, and there is the pituitary gland there, this little gland, and the pituitary gland looks like a little olive. If you go to cocktail parties, it looks like an olive. And the doctor could just snip out the pituitary. If there's a tumor on the tumor might look like a little piece of cottage cheese on top of the olive. So the doctor looks up there in the base of your brain, and he snips out this little piece of cottage cheese, and your Cushing's disease gets better. So one of the few people in the world who could do this procedure was Charles Wilson. He was a neurosurgeon, and he's a runner, little man, you know, fast-moving little man. And he has equally fast little lady. Her name is Miss Eno. So he and she would go from patient to patient. And, you know, they looked like, and she had a little clipboard, and they looked like two hummingbirds going from blossom to blossom, which they reminded me of. So people came from all over the world to get treated for their Cushing's disease by the famous Dr. Wilson. One year, a lady came from Italy. I call her Mrs. Vito Velli. That's not her real name. I protect patient confidentiality in this book. She had a mild form of Cushing's disease. She had some menstrual period problems, and her face was a little round. She worked out, too. So she was going to get treated for Cushing's disease at the university. That weekend, I was home. I lived 20 miles from the hospital, and I didn't think I'd get called very much. I got called. An emergency. Dr. Schmidt, there's an emergency. Mrs. Vito Velli, there's something horrible wrong with Mrs. Vito Velli. She's crying. She's upset. She's pointing to her head. She's pointing to her stomach. She speaks Italian. We don't speak English. We don't know what's going on with her. Could you come in? So, oh, my God. So I got in my car and started driving in. What's going on with this young woman? She's having a heart attack. She's bled into her brain. What's going on with it? What could be going on with her? So finally, I made it to the ward. I got up to the ward. There, Mrs. Vito Velli, poor Mrs. Vito Velli, she's sitting on her bed crying. As soon as she sees me, she runs up to me and starts crying and hugging me. And she's pointing to her head, pointing to her stomach, and running around. And so I did a bunch of tests. I did a physical exam. I did labs. I did x-rays. Everything was normal. What is going on with this woman? Finally, we found someone in the hospital who spoke Italian. This is what happened. They put her in a room with two women who came back for follow-up. These women had got round and fat with their Cushing's disease. And then they got their tumor snipped, and they got better. They were there for follow-up. Each of these ladies somehow conveyed to Mrs. Vito Valli that after the surgery, you lose 100 pounds. She only weighed 100 pounds to begin with. She thought she was going to disappear. That was the big crisis in my fellowship there. So that's the woman who thought she was going to disappear.
You have some stories right here in Richmond. When we walked into the studio earlier, you were telling me about the man you thought you had lost.
Oh, yes, I had. Yes. I had a patient. I actually tell my patients, I'm at the VA, I do make house calls. I said, I will make a house call if necessary. I do make house calls. I had a patient. I call him Mr. Monroe. He got involved in a study. To learn how to treat medicine right, to treat people right, we have to do research and things like that. There was a research office by Medical College of Virginia called Hemodyne. They did research on diabetes, and I got involved with them. Part of the protocol for the study was to get people on two diabetes pills a day. And then they would go to MCV, go to the other clinic, and they would wind up getting admitted to the place, and they get tests, stool studies, urine studies, and things like that. This patient, Mr. Monroe, was only on 1.5 pills, and I really wanted to get him on 2 pills. The American Diabetes Association criteria, he really should have been on 2 pills, not 1.5. I had him on 1.5 because I had my own feelings. I'm an endocrinologist, and it was not certain what the ideal at that point. That was up in the air. So I put him on 2 pills, which was certainly kosher by the American Diabetes Association criteria. But in my mind, I knew I had increased his medicine to get him on the study. And I worried about this. It was my conscience got me. So I started calling.
What was the worry in putting him on 2 pills instead of 1.5?
That sugar would get too low. That was the reason. It's simply in medicine, if you do something by the book, always for your patient, I believe God takes care of you. And as long as you always are thinking, putting your patients first. At that point, in the back of my mind, I realized I was doing something for myself to get the patient on the study. It was perfectly legitimate because, according to the American Diabetes Association criteria, he needed to be on 2 pills. Okay, so but in my mind, I knew I was doing it to get him in the study. That's what the little intellectual quandary I was in. So I started calling him up. I was here one Friday, and about 6 p.m., I called him at home. I was worried about his sugar, and I got a little old lady on the phone. I said, "Can I please talk to Mr. Monroe?" And she says, "Just a minute." She runs up. He lived up on the 3rd floor. She comes down. She's all out of breath, and she says, I'm going to imitate her accent. Okay. She says, I knock on the door, and he don't answer. I know he's there, but he don't answer. So I said, please have him call me. So I left my number. Wandering around the hospital, he doesn't answer. 8 o'clock, I called again. I said, this is Dr. Schmidt. Can I please talk to Mr. Monroe? The little old lady answers. She says, just a minute. And she runs up the stairs, and she's all out of breath. I'm putting this 4-year-old lady through cardiac stress to find out about. She says, he's all out of breath. He says, I knock on the door, and he don't answer. I know he's there, but he don't answer. Why doesn't he answer? I said, please have him call Dr. Schmidt. So I'm waiting around the hospital, getting anxious. 10 o'clock at night on a Friday night, call him again. I said, this is Dr. Schmidt. Can I please talk to that Mr. Monroe? And she said, just a minute. And she disappears, and I hear her going off and upstairs. And then I hear a man's voice, and I thought, oh, maybe that's him. But it was another man. And finally, the little old lady comes down. She says, I knock on the door. She's now really out of breath. She says, I knock on the door, and he don't answer. You know, I know he's there, but he don't answer. And then she starts thinking out loud on the phone. She says, doctor, keep calling. Maybe he's sick. He must be sick. Then she pauses. And then she says, maybe he dead. At that point, I lost it. I freaked out. Oh, my God. She's right. You know, he died. He's dying. His blood sugar's low. He's unconscious in the door. I'm just catastrophizing. And then I'm on the phone. I said, can you knock down the door? She says, I can't knock down the door. I mean, it's a wooden door. Yeah. Then I said, well, call a rescue squad. Well, I'm telling, this is a horrible neighborhood. He lives in this crime-ridden neighborhood. the rescue, I'm going to tell the rescue squad there's a man in a room that has low blood sugar. I want you to go over there and break down the door. They would never do that. So what am I going to do? Finally, I said, okay, I'm coming over there. So I hung up the phone. I went out in the parking lot. It's dark. It's in the fall. And I go out, get my car, and I drove to his house, which was in a very, very dangerous, crime-ridden neighborhood. And I could people have been murdered. Their names are in the papers and things like that. And I'm scared.
Right here in Richmond.
In Richmond, yeah. I'm scared. The moon's coming up. It's like, and I can find his house. I can see the street sign, the address on the curb. And I go up to the door. I'm getting ready to knock on the door. And on this porch is an old refrigerator. And behind the refrigerator, there's somebody lurking. It's a man lurking. And I said, oh, my God, this is it. I'm going to be murdered. I'm going to be in the newspaper. So I turned to face my murderer. And the man steps into the moonlight, and I recognize him. This is my patient, Mr. Monroe. The old lady had been wrong. He had not been in the room. He'd been out all day. He came home, and she told him, your doctor's coming over. So I was delighted for two reasons. I gave him a hug. I was delighted that he wasn't going to kill me. And I was delighted that I hadn't killed him. So now I had to explain what I'm doing, making a house call at midnight. He had diabetes, and he had a glucometer, the machine that you measure your sugar with, which is new. I said, I came over to check your glucometer. So we sat down on the porch in the moonlight, and we went through his blood sugar readings. A couple weeks later, I get in my box at the VA, there is a manila envelope. Like an official manila envelope. Often these things are bad. It's like you did something wrong. It's official. And it's like from the director's office. And I open this thing up, and it's a letter. Dr. Schmidt is the best doctor in the world. He calls me all the time to check on me. And he even came over to my house to check my glucometer at midnight. Signed, Percy Monroe, Master Sergeant, United States Navy, retired. The United States Army, retired. And then underneath it was a little a note from the director of the hospital said, keep up the good work, and so forth. So I do make house calls.
And sometimes it turns out very nicely.
Yeah.
The book is Speed Bumps and CC Flies. There are far more anecdotes than Dr. Schmidt has been telling you. The book is available on Amazon. I think you'll enjoy it. We've been hearing from Dr. James Schmidt, who is in charge of internal medicine at the McGuire Veterans Hospital here in Richmond. You're listening to The Writer's Voice on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.